The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. A California judge says authorities can collect DNA from the man accused in a series of rapes and murders that terrorized California for a decade in the 70s and 80s. This is the case of the Golden State Killer. Last week, the FBI announced they'd solved it after 40 years, and they did it by using genealogy. Detectives use DNA from a crime scene to make a fake profile on a genealogy site, they won't say which one, to find the killer's family members and follow a trail that led to former police officer Joseph DeAngelo. That raised some ethical and legal eyebrows, and I have a couple of those eyebrow raisers here with me now. Malia Fullerton, professor of bioethics at the University of Washington. Welcome, Professor.
Hello.
Steve Mercer, forensic science attorney and partner at the law firm. Is it Rakeen Mercer?
Yes, Bill. Thank you.
Rakeen Mercer. Steve Mercer, thanks for coming. So this is the Sacramento County Sheriff Scott Jones last week.
It was always going to be DNA that solved this case. So that was ultimately any investigation, that's where it was ultimately going to lead, DNA. And so we knew at that point it was good enough. We couldn't exclude him. So we had to say, all right, we need to test this DNA. And that's what we did.
Steve Mercer, how comfortable are you with using DNA the way authorities did to catch the accused Golden State Killer?
Well, it's easy to applaud the success of the Golden State Killer investigation, but DNA identification raises unique privacy concerns. Here, police created a dummy user account, uploaded an ancestry DNA profile, and searched for relatives who were then targeted for further investigation. There really are very few legal rules that apply in this area. And the starting point has to be assessing the weight of the interest in genetic privacy, which is substantial. And I think in a situation, for example, where Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, where people submitted personal information for one purpose that was then used for an entirely different purpose, caused a lot of outrage. We're in a similar situation here where people who submitted their DNA to an ancestry site are suddenly realizing that it can be put to very different uses than they ever intended.
Bioethics Professor Malia Fullerton, what's your take on the bioethics here?
Well, I generally agree. We have known for a while that putting one's genetic information in the public domain exposes people to risks to their genetic privacy. What was very unusual about this case was it was what's referred to as a third-party interpretation site. So a direct-to-consumer genetic company like Ancestry.com or 23andMe that somebody goes to and pays for generates.
So I send my saliva to Ancestry.com?
Yeah.
Yes, or 23andMe,
and you do that for the purposes of learning things about familial relationships and ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get that information back from the company, some of these companies...
They send me a data file.
They now will give you access to your raw data file.
Yeah.
And what happened here was people who were interested in extending and getting additional information uploaded that raw data file to this third-party interpretation site, which has now since been identified. It's called GEDmatch.
GEDmatch.
And they did that intentionally in order to find people who they were closely related to, and that is what the police used to identify the serial killer.
And let's say I'm the saliva sampler. Mm-hmm. What did I agree to when I gave my data file to GEDmatch?
Well, you agreed. They have different options, but if you want relatives to find you, you agreed to have your genetic sequence accessible by other people using the third-party interpretation service, and you agreed for them to get in contact with you if they found some kind of match which suggested some kind of family history, shared family history.
So, attorney Steve Mercer, I agreed. I clicked yes, right? I told him, do what you want with it, with my DNA.
Well, if I submit my DNA to an ancestry site to learn about my genealogy, I don't expect the swab patrol to show up for my children's DNA or my brother's DNA or my parents' DNA. You know, the idea that the data was shared to identify relatives, the purpose wasn't to give law enforcement an opportunity to search my family tree to look for a suspect. That's an entirely different use, and not one that I think any reasonable person would intend when they're sharing that data to learn about their ancestry. And again, you know, I've heard many people say, well, you know, I would be happy if I had a serial rapist in my family tree for the police to then go and arrest. But
right.
there's no assurance that this is limited to serious crimes.
Why? What's the worst case scenario?
Well, the worst case scenario is what we see playing out at the local level in underregulated law enforcement databanks that contain DNA profiles from crime scenes that can't be submitted to a national regulated databank, and DNA from suspects, crime victims, and other innocent people. And those databanks are being used for very misdemeanor crimes, property crimes, trespass, rogue vagabond, these types of offenses. Because you have to remember, when police are investigating a crime or collecting evidence, they're collecting DNA not just at serious crimes, but also at misdemeanor, quality of life, broken window type offenses, because swifter, cheaper, more sensitive testing allows police to extract a DNA profile from a single human cell that can be shed just by touching something. So this is really opening up a Pandora's box when this technique of familial searching that was used here, which is vastly more powerful than the forms of familial searching that have been used before, which were limited to just looking essentially for the genetic equivalent of a last name. Now there's these profiles, these genetic profiles look at 700,000 locations on the human genome, which contains an awesome amount of information.
Okay.
And that is allowing police to search out to third, fourth degree relatives. And here, for example, back to great, great, great grandfather in the 1800s.
Yes.
It's just unprecedented, that power of that technology.
So then, bioethics professor Fullerton, Steve there brought up the idea of this is not just a serial killers, it's misdemeanors and trespasses. It's a broken windows. When we think of the broken windows problem, we think of police profiling for minor accusations, profiling poor and brown people, for example. Mm-hmm. Is there some way that I should worry about a certain kind of person being profiled by powerful DNA possessors?
Well, I mean, it can happen. I think what's interesting, and other people have pointed out, that we already have sort of disproportionate representation of ethnic minorities in forensic databases. And so one alternative ethical argument, sort of the flip side, is, well, maybe we should be using these genealogical resources, which tend to be populated more often by people of European ancestry, middle class, well-to-do, have enough disposable income in order to kind of do an ancestry test and dabble in genealogy on the side. So maybe this is righting some of those biases. However, I do agree that the way the police went about this exposed a very large number of people. They identified more than 25 families that matched this individual's DNA sample, and they had to kind of systematically step through multiple generations of family history in order to arrive at the single individual that they eventually identified. That's exposing a bunch of completely innocent people to enhanced surveillance in ways that we don't even fully know. There have been accounts. There was a particularly detailed account in the Washington Post, but we don't know exactly what the Sacramento Police Department did here in order to get to the individual that they've eventually decided is the person who left those DNA samples at those crime scenes.
Steve, we got less than 2 minutes. It sounded like you wanted to react to that.
Well, yeah, two quick points. Number one, I can't fathom how expanding law enforcement presence and intrusions into private DNA databanks is going to remedy the racial bias and prejudices that results in a disproportionate number of racial minorities in law enforcement databanks that are both regulated and unregulated. So I just reject that premise flat out. That's nothing but an invitation for a universal DNA databank.
Which might right injustices here.
It doesn't resolve the biases and prejudices that result in the problem in the first instance based on race in our criminal justice system. It just masks it. So it's not a remedy.
We're out of time, unfortunately. Forensic science attorney Steve Mercer, former chief attorney of the Forensics Division at the Office of the Public Defender of Maryland. Steve, thanks for talking this through with us.
Thank you, Bill.
And Malia Fullerton, Associate Professor of Bioethics and Humanities at University of Washington School of Medicine, talking about the legal, ethical, difficulties raised by this high-profile catching of a suspected serial killer in California. You might want to know what you're in for and what your descendants are in for when you submit that saliva. Professor, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And thank you for tuning in to The Record. We're going to come right back with the writer, the essayist, music culture critic, Chuck Klosterman. Stay tuned.